Hello, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Keith. By God's grace, Alcoholics Anonymous, rooms full of people like you and a little effort on my own. I haven't had to take a drink or do any dope since May the 11th, 1976, and for that I'm especially grateful. I'm glad to be here and glad to be sober, and I want to thank Ray and the committee for inviting Sue and I to come and participate in the program this weekend and to be on a program with some of the other people that mean a lot to me. I have a lot of people here this evening that from my home group. The small contingent came from Orange County of AAs and Al-Anons, and I'd like for them to stand up. Please, come on, you guys, stand up. My home group, the Dog on the Roof, is a men's stag, and I love my home group, and Sue's home group is an Al-Anon group, the Gotawana Al-Anon group, and those two groups of guys and gals have over 12 panels into institutions that they participate in a month. I mean, they take panels, they take people into in all kinds of institutions, and I'm very, you know, that's... When you have that kind of participation in hospital institution work, you don't have any trouble getting people to help you around the room in the meeting, I'll guarantee. You don't have any problem with people setting up chairs or cleaning ashtrays or doing that kind of stuff. When they're going in and out of penitentiaries and hospitals and nut wards and those kind of deals, they're grateful for their home group and they're grateful for freedom, I'll guarantee you. We've had a panel on 6 and down on 6 in San Pedro and Los Angeles, Skid Row, for over 12 years. And, I personally have been involved with hospitals and institution work way before I sobered up. Matter of fact, I come from that Texas bunch before they got some culture. So I'm extremely grateful to be a part of hospital and institution work, and it's a very important part of my service and my sobriety, and I've gone in and out of those types of service groups ever since I started out in early sobriety. I lied about how long I was sober to get into my first jail panel. And my sponsor said, "You've lied about everything else. You might as well lie about that too." So I started going in there. And for almost between five and six years now, I've had a panel into CIW. The women, God has a funny sense of humor. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was a woman hater, and I get a panel in a woman's prison with a room full of men haters. And I'm going to tell you that's the most spiritual thing today that I've ever encountered in the whole program of Alcoholics Anonymous, because they have literally sponsored me through those feelings, and I have been able to sponsor them through. My wife has a panel in that same institution, and she's had a panel in there for over almost six years in the CIW, and our whole family's been in there. We take regular people in there, and one of the most important things about having that kind of commitment is that there's any panel I've ever had, I've never had a dark night. And that's one of the most important things, to build trust. And it taught me how to build trust and consistency. And those have been the things that, you know, that have been gradually... allowed me to build the gratitude that I hold for my sobriety and the program and the people in it. And, you know, the people that go into the hospitals and institutions are the bunch that can make those commitments. And there's very little spotlight in that kind of stuff. There's very little, you know, big deals. It's a very humble service. And I believe it's one of the most gratifying things that I've experienced, because it's, you know, it's... gratitude in action, and I'm extremely grateful for that. I sponsor a lot of I kind of get the bent fenders. I thought it was kind of ironic that the newcomers that I brought with me are sitting in front of the signing lady. You're in the right place. I don't know if there's anybody there you're supposed to be with, but I brought some guys there that need it. I'll ask them next week what they learned tonight, and they'll do this. And they won't know what they got, and neither will I. But I know the Al-Anons moved over to the right of that. You know the difference between an Al-Anon and a dog? Dog quits whining when you let him in. I had to use one of their jokes on him. I'm very grateful my wife went to Al-Anon. I really am, and I have a great respect for the program of Al-Anon and Alateen. My daughter went to Alateen and graduated into Al-Anon, and our whole family is involved in this program and started out that way and still is. And it's an amazing thing because in the very beginning, my whole family is a bunch of drunks. I grew up in a bunch of drunks in the Texas-Oklahoma panhandle out there, and there's been all kinds of hospitals and institutions involved with my family throughout, historically, and no big deal, not anything, I don't think that it would label us anything. It was just, had a brother that was retarded at childbirth, and he went around, he carried a steering wheel around town, and everybody accepted him, he was institutionalized the last 15 years of his life until he passed on. And I'd get drunk and try to beat the heck out of somebody that parked over my brother's car, When he'd lay his steering wheel down in a parking place, somebody'd park over that steering wheel. You're parking on my brother's car. I might just have to whip you, I'd go crazy, and he'd just wander around, He didn't care. He'd crawl down there and get his steering wheel and drive off, When he needed to go to the bathroom, he'd just unzip his pants and go. At least he had the decency to unzip his pants. I just went whenever, And they always said he was touched in the head, I started out, it's an interesting thing, when Jim started talking about when he got involved with his service through the prison system, it was about time I started going. It's kind of ironic, you get both sides of it at these deals, I always wondered what those people thought about us, I remember I was at an AA meeting, it was a men's stag, and it turned out I didn't realize I stumbled into it. I must have lost my instinctive ability there for a minute and stumbled into a men's stag, and it was all cops. And they were going around in circles sharing about their fears, and they were all, they just went around and around and around. And each one of them said their biggest fear was every time they knocked on one of those doors, they figured there's some wacko behind that door with a machine gun. And when it came to my turn, I said, it was me. I'm that guy. And only in AA, only in AA would you be able to do that, your dreams will come true. I'm your worst nightmare. I started when I was about 12, 13 years old. I started being locked up I was put in a boys' what I guess you would call a reform school. It's for problem children. We didn't think it was a problem. That's kind of like our character defects. My character defects are not a problem to me unless they bother me. They may be driving you nuts, but if it don't bother me, it's not a character defect. And by the time I was 12, 13 years old, I'd gotten in trouble, and they locked me up with a bunch of other people like me, and I learned a lot of things. I learned certain things, but I did do quite well in a controlled environment. I did quite well in a controlled environment. I was during those years of my adolescence, I guess I was involved in sports. They had a rigorous sports program, and most of it contact sports because it was a men's institution, and we were able to take out all of our frustration on each other and punching bags and any kind of physical sports and what have you. And I graduated out of that thing, what would be equivalent to a senior in high school. I graduated out of and I did good. I did good in my, as far as classes or schooling, what have you. I got along with the people that I was locked up with. They had some very, it was back in the Oklahoma panhandle there, and they didn't, if you did wrong, they took you in the little room and they whacked you real good. And so you knew the consequences of your actions. And I knew the difference between right and wrong. I also learned how to, get high off of airplane glue. They could smuggle airplane glue in you know, put it in a paper bag, and we'd all stick our head in a paper bag and inhale airplane glue, you know, until you kind of got sticky all over, you know. I learned how those inhalers, those old inhalers that have I look back on that now, you know, they used to have those inhalers that had Benzedrine or Dexedrine in it, and you'd cut that cotton, you know, and swallow that cotton, and you had to throw it up within a few hours, or it constipated you for a week. Yeah. But we were locked up, and we wanted to stay up for 3 days. I mean, I look back, it's got to be crazy. Why would you want, you're locked up in a little room, you want to stay up for 3 days, be sure you don't miss nothing, you know? Count the cockroaches, you know? I mean, it's just, you know, I used to sniff the nurse would bring, they'd bring a nurse in there once a week, and we'd all take a hit off the gas, you know, go, and then they've got some locking gas cap on that deal, and, but I functioned quite well, and when they let me out of there, I was, 17 years old, and I immediately got in trouble. 17 and a half years old, I started bootlegging. Oklahoma had dry counties back then, and Texas Panhandle had dry counties, and I started bootlegging. I was running whiskey out of Wichita Falls, Texas, up into Oklahoma City and in that area, and I had a dump truck that had a bunch of dirt in the back of it, and me and a couple of partners were delivering whiskey to phone booths. You could go to a phone booth, call this number, we'd deliver you a fifth of whiskey. The seal was busted, of course, because we watered the whiskey down. Ain't going to give you quality stuff if it's delivered in a dump truck. But the weeds, I had a false bed on it, had the whiskey in this dump truck, and the weeds started growing up in the dirt in the top of the damn dump truck, and the cops were watching me, and I never dumped the load. And that's how they busted me. They busted me for bootlegging, and I said, how'd you know that? And he said, because I watched you go down the street, people driving that truck down the street, and the weeds kept getting higher in the back of that truck. I mean, there's so, alcoholics miss something somewhere there. You can always find us in the paper in the arrest section, attempted rape, attempted robbery, you know, all those things. I attempted to do it all, but I just missed it just by a little bit. I never thought about mowing my yard, you know, in a truck, you know. And so I got in a little light trouble there and decided to get married. And, well, it seemed like it worked for other people. But I'm the kind of guy, go over to your house and get a dog out of the litter, and I'll get the sickest dog out of the litter, you know what I mean? So you can line 10 women up against that wall over there, and I'll get the sickest one out of the bunch every time. And I ended up with a little gal down in Galveston. I moved down to South Texas, and I was hanging around down in the red light district in Galveston. That was a beautiful place to drink. The police station was on one side of the street, and the red light district was on the other side of the street. And we'd drink and then just go over and check herself in, you know. And I married a little gal down there, and we set up a little light housekeeping. It lasted 9 months, and her father had a lot of money, and they called me in. I had a little hit and run with bodily injury and had some non-habit-forming marijuana, traces of that in the automobile I was driving. And back then in Texas, if you got busted with any weed, you did 25 to life. And so I was looking at some real problems there, and this little gal I was married to, father came and had a little serious conversation with me. He said, you know, I've got a lot of money. And I said, I've noticed that. That's one thing alcoholics always notice. That comes before love. And then you know if you're love or not, if there's pain. And so I recognized all those things, and he said, I didn't get all my money by making bad investments, and you're a bad investment. And they divorced me. And my daddy, who's a drunken lawyer, came down and defended me. Now, that was hope. He couldn't practice. He was from Oklahoma. He couldn't practice law in Texas, so he had to hire a drunken lawyer from Texas. So I had two drunken lawyers representing me. And they say those who represent themselves as a fool for a client. I mean, I don't know how I got out of that deal. Matter of fact, I didn't get out of that deal, to tell you the truth. I had to do a little time. And so I did my first little inventory while I was doing that time down there. And I look back on my life, and I recognize that, you know, when I hang around with these good old boys, I get in trouble. And they're good old boys, but I get in trouble all the time. And I hang around these crazy women and drive them fast cars and do all these things. I get in trouble, and I got to stay out of trouble. And I look back over my life, and I recognized that, and they let me out of jail down in South Texas there after doing 18 months, and I caught a train up to Amarillo, Texas, and I got me a jug of whiskey, and I started thinking, and you shouldn't do that. You should never think and drink whiskey at the same time. I found that out later, but at the time it seemed like the thing to do, and I started thinking about all the things that I wasn't going to do and things that I was going to do and what I needed to do and when, and the train pulled in there, and I drank that whiskey, and my two very best friends were waiting on me, Oily and Goose. And Oily and Goose were a couple of good old boys, redneck tough, good old boys, had an old beat-up pickup truck, a couple of dogs in the back, shotgun and rifle hanging in the back window. They had some 3-2 beer and some White Lightning, moonshine, and some Bennies. And I crawled in that pickup truck, and we took off for the Panhandle, and we started eating Bennies and drinking moonshine and 3-2 beer. And I told him, I said, I got to quit hanging around with guys like you. Goose was a blade man. He could whip a knife out of his back pocket and cut all the buttons off your shirt before you could swallow. And Oily would just smell like grease. He just, you know. I don't know what his claim to fame is. He's still alive. Married a young girl. That solved his problem. But they picked me up in that pickup truck, and we took off for Wolf Creek to go to a dance. We pulled into that old dance, and it was about midnight, and the band had taken an intermission, and, you know, I was back to town, man, and I wheeled in there, and they had a platform up like this, and one of them old Western bands up there, and they hit the last note as we come in the door, and everybody split. I don't know where they was going. They was heading out the doors, pairing up. He's gonna either fiddle, whittle, or diddle. I don't know. They's taking off. And, bunch of hairy-legged old boys standing around the room, and I grabbed a Coke bottle, rolled it down, bumped the stage, and I said, let the meanest sucker in the house bring that back. I'm in town. And it looked like a stampede coming my direction. And they were all drunk, and I hit the first guy leading the charge as hard as I could, and figured if he's stupid enough to lead the charge, he deserves to get hit. So I punched him hard and took off, because you hang around a brawl like that, you get beat up. I may be sick, but I'm not crazy. And I ran for the woman's restroom, and as I went in the door of the woman's restroom, there's a lady standing there, and I said, tell me when the fight's over, and I ran in and jumped on one of them stools and locked the door and hid. And pretty soon she stuck her head in and said, you can come out now, cowboy, and I went rolling out, and the band was playing, and she was handy, so I asked her to dance. And right away I violated all the things that I'd, you know, said I wasn't going to do. I got in a fight, hanging out with Oily and Goose, fell in love, same night. And one quick dance while she was handy there, I said, where you been? I haven't seen you around. She said, where you been? I haven't seen you around. I said, well, I just got out of the joint down there and did 18 months. And she said, well, I just got out of an unwed mother's home. I said, hell, baby, we deserve each other. I said, stick with me. I'll take you places you've never been before. I did, too. Most of them, she didn't want to go, but I took her anyway. You know how we are. I mean, and you can't get no sicker than that. Two people just got out of an institution. They're in love. And that's what all the psychiatric help did for me while I was in there, I'll guarantee you. And she was in there for something, and she got them right out, and bam, there she is, hooked up again. We dated for 2 weeks, and the people in that little town where we live nicknamed us Hatchet and Hammer. You know? And we set out a life of rip-roaring, just insane, insane living right away. And she didn't drink much because she got sick all the time, so she was a designated driver before that was popular. And, I mean, it was just, you know, crazy. And a lot of physical violence, a lot of violence. People say, I never hit a woman. I said, you never live with Sue, I'll guarantee you. We used to beat the hell out of each other and call it foreplay, you know. I mean, it's just unbelievable, crazy. And I got in jail a lot. They're supposed to take care of me. That was her job, you know. And I'd end up getting in jail, and she'd come and write a hot check and get me out. And I'd just get back in there, because I'm the kind of guy who drink three beers and go to jail. I just always got in trouble all the time. Might have been because I did a lot of amphetamines, and so I was up whenever everybody else was down. And so, you know, police notice you when you're up. Moving around, yeah. Especially in a town of 3,000, you know. I mean, if you're whacked out on speed running the streets, why, you know, there ain't nobody but you and the cops, you know. There he goes. Look at that little sucker, man. Wow, wow, wow. You know, just, they didn't know what to do with me. Every once in a while, they'd capture me, you know. But we always get loose, you know. And I ended up having a little girl. I don't remember sitting down and discussing that, because I didn't know the responsibilities behind that. I didn't even know when she got pregnant, but I was probably crossing over the invisible line when it happened. I tried to do the right thing, and eventually, after a period of time, I kept getting in trouble, so we had to leave. I had to leave Texas, and in AA, they call them trips geographics, but when I left Texas, they call it unlawful flight to avoid prosecution. Loaded up everything and took off, come to California. A friend of mine named Lion Shorty offered me a job on a ranch 40 miles west of Long Beach, and I didn't have sense enough to know that was ocean, you know, I mean. You know, hope, man. I mean, hope. Don't worry. Come on, let's go. I know, you know, there's something out there somewhere. For me, anyway. You know. And everybody's crazy the time we got there, and I moved right in. Wherever I go, I take me. There's something about people like me. I leave an old neighborhood just full of crazy people and move right into a neighborhood just like a magnet, man. Just zoom. Found a hell of a deal on a house. Moved into this house. A bunch of hippies on one side and motorcycle gang on the other side. You know, I left Texas to get away from that. The hippies weren't quite so good down in Texas by then. They just called them white trash down there, you know. Time we got out here, why, you know, here they were, man. They were dropping LSD, taking their clothes off, laying in the front yard, watching the sun come up and go down, you know. And I never seen anything like that. I had to leave Oil and Goose back in Texas, so I had to make two new friends over there next door at the hippie house. There was a guy named Doc, another guy named Professor. And I figured anybody named Doc and Professor probably had all the answers to all my questions, and at least they did down in Texas when I was locked up, and these guys were loose, you know, so I'd go over there and talk to them. I said, you know, the problem I'm having is when I drink whiskey, I go crazy. They said, well, maybe you're part Indian. No, I never thought of that. I had a cousin who's Indian, and my granddaddy, he was an old Indian fighter. Hell, he fought with my grandma for years. And they said, what you need to do is you need to quit drinking whiskey. And I figured, Doc, he figured that out. I said, well, what do I do? And he said, well, you should smoke tie sticks. Oh, what's that? I said, what do you do when you smoke tie sticks? He said, oh, we hang around the park and wait for the ice cream truck to come by. I never wanted to wait on no ice cream truck. I always wanted to rob the ice cream truck. But since I was an Indian, I might as well have a reservation. So that's what it was for me. I mean, tie sticks was a reservation. I found myself standing in front of a judge, and the judge was talking to me about me, and he had the right guy. And I don't remember what it was I was supposed to be talking to him about, so I listened. And during a period of conversation, why they suggested to me that I go to A&A. And I'd never been to A&A, and so I'd heard about it. The people I hung out in jail, they didn't go to AA, but they heard about it, and we didn't go, because funny people go. And besides that, if you're not going to quit drinking, why go, you know? And if you're drunk, why go? I mean, I never could figure out till later why I went to an AA meeting drunk, because I didn't know you couldn't. See, I found that out later, after I went to AA, but I wasn't an alcoholic. I went to AA because the judge said I needed to go to AA. I went to AA because she said I needed to go to AA. I went to AA because my kid said I should go to AA. I went to AA because the dog said I should go to AA. I went to AA because the boss and the neighbors and everybody else said I'd go to AA. But I wasn't an alcoholic. And I knew that because I did another little inventory. And I looked around and I said, you know, I'm just on the verge of solving my problem here. And if you're just on the verge of solving your problem, you really don't have a problem. And besides that, I went next door and talked to Doc. And they sent me to AA, and I went to AA, and I didn't do anything for a little while, and then all of a sudden I got struck drunk. Just got out of the blue, just got struck drunk. And my life changed. I guarantee it changed. And I ended up getting worse, and as it gets worse, it gets worser. There's an amazing thing. I don't know about anybody else, but my institutional progression, along with my drunkalogue, is that I progressively went from, you know, the little country jails to the big city jails to do a little time. Then I moved right on into the nut wards, right on into the institutions, the padded rooms. And I remember one time I was just wacko running all over everywhere, crazier than heck, and they captured me because I was going to commit suicide. And I took all my clothes off, got me a fifth of wild turkey. You're going to commit suicide while, you know, drink good whiskey. And I had two 45 automatics with extra clips and hand-tooled shoulder holsters, and I pull them up in front of the front door, and I knew what she's going to do. She's going to run down the street, get the cops going to come up, get the bullhorn out, and they're going to blow my name off the loudspeaker out in the front in the street, and I ain't going to go out, and they're going to kick the door down, and I'm going to draw, and we're going to have a big shootout. And then it'll be in the papers that I went out, and I'll be a hero in my neighborhood. And I don't know where that thought come from. Just an intuitive thought, that's all. And so I got all naked with my guns and pulled up in front of there, and cops come down there where she was. She gave them the key to the front door. They come up and open the front door just as I was taking a drink out of that jug, and I didn't get a chance to draw. And they said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm going to commit suicide." They said, "You need two 45 automatics, extra clips in order to commit suicide?" I said, "Yeah, I'm a bad shot when I drink wild turkey. I don't..." Took my guns off, took me out in the front yard, bare-ass naked, put one of them straight jackets, you know, I love me not sports coats on that ties in the back, bare-ass naked. The hippies come out and call the cops pigs while they got me out in the front yard naked. I told them later, don't call the cops pigs when they're beating on me. I don't do that when they come to your house. Take me down the nut ward, tie me up down in there in the nut ward on one of them four-point restraints, and I'm laying there and screaming, had an out-of-body experience. Kind of floated up out of myself and looked down on myself. And I said to myself, "Self, why are you screaming?" And I looked down, and the other people tied down in there in that room were screaming, and I didn't want to be different. So I just screamed with the rest of them. They got some psychiatrists come over there and looked at me and give me that look. And I had to have a story because I'd been there before. And so I told them, "I know what's the matter with me. I was in the big war. I mean the real big war. And they trained me to be a train killer, and I was a paratrooper, and they took me, I don't know, put all this stuff on me, took me 15, 20,000 feet in the air, I don't know, way up there, and everybody started jumping, and it came my turn to jump, and I froze right in the door, and a guy kicked me in the butt, and I fell out of that airplane, I don't know, 15, 20,000 feet, my chute didn't open, I landed a tree, flung me over, lit on my head. Laid there 3 or 4 days, people come and got me, took me, put me in this hospital, said, something's wrong with that boy's head. Some doctor looked at me, and he said, "Here, take these pills." And so I take these little pills, and when I take these little pills and drink whiskey, I go crazy. And that psychiatrist said, "Oh." He left the room, and he went and called my wife up. And he said, "Oh, he's in the wrong hospital. He should be down at the VA hospital." She said, "What for? He's never been in the service. They kicked him out." Just when I had a good story going, man, everybody was going with it. She wouldn't go along with it. That guy come back in there and looked at me and said, "Boy, you're a walking encyclopedia of worthless information." Hell, I thought I was a book of knowledge. They gave me a little card, said I was crazy, said I could come back anytime I wanted to and stick it in the door, that little slot in the door to let myself in. I know better than that. There ain't no doorknobs on the inside of them doors. I've been there. But I did take that card down to this bar where I was drinking and showed it to my friends. Card-carrying nut. When you got a card like that, they nickname you animal or psycho or something like that. I don't know which is a step up, you know. And, you know, my life changed. I had a lot of violence. There was a lot of violence. There was always a lot of violence, and we attracted that kind of a thing. And there was a lot of the neighborhood and the people in the neighborhood, physically violent. I carried guns all the time. I like guns. They enhance conversation. And you can slap somebody upside the head with a .44 mag and pop a cap right by their ear, and they'll pay attention to you. They won't hear nothing, but they'll pay attention to you. And my wife started carrying a 12-inch butcher knife around, you know, all the time. Every night that I slept in that house, I had a loaded gun with a hammer back, a safety off, laying on the nightstand. And on 1911A45... with a round in the chamber, safety off, and the hammer back, kept it in that night table all the time there, and I laid it up there. Every time I laid down in that bed next to that woman, I put that gun on the nightstand. And she took that butcher knife and stuck it either in between the mattress or underneath her pillow. Now, that's about as spiritual as I'm going to get. Those weapons was not to protect us from people outside of the house. And we lived that way for almost 13 years. We loved each other a lot. One time I came home and passed out on her 15 minutes into a two-hour conversation. They do not like rejection. So she stabbed me all over my back. When I came to, I said, "God, something's wrong with my back." She said, "Oh, let me look." You know how they are. She said, "You broke out of acne of the back, drinking that old rot gut whiskey." She said, "Let me get the rubbing alcohol." I'm going to tell you something. Them Baptists down in South Texas tried to baptize me with all kinds of holy water, but that alcohol got me closer to Jesus than anything I ever had. We used to stand toe-to-toe in the front room, and I'd stick my gun right on the end of her nose. She'd stick her knife right in my stomach, and she'd say, "You go first." I said, "You're crazy. If I shoot you, you'll die." She said, "I know, but when the bullet hits me, I'll go backwards, and the knife will go forward, and you'll die too." You know that Oriental warriors trained all their life. They're willing to give up, some of them, in a certain category there of a warrior, they're willing to give up their life in order to get the last kill. A sick woman knows that intuitively. Don't need to be trained at all. And I ended up getting a lot of trouble. I was moving around. I ended up with a lot of violence. And you know, the amazing thing is, as I slid down that scale of living, I took my family, the people I ran with. If you live like an animal, think like an animal, smell like an animal, you got to defend yourself like an animal. And the amazing thing, you can take everything away from a human being, people, places, and things out of our life, money, property, prestige out of our life, and we'll still resemble a human being. But once you lose your dignity, you have nothing left to lose, and you're near an animal as a human being can be. And alcohol and narcotics took me to that point of life where I had no value for life. Just like the big book says, there is a point where we drink to a point where we cannot distinguish the difference between true and false, right and wrong. And that's where it took me. It took me down to a point where I, a year and a half before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous in May of 1976, I stood in front of a judge in a little town in Beatty, Nevada, up there, and I've been up there on a run with a bunch of people, a motorcycle gang that I ran with, and a bunch of people up there, and I got in a bar fight, and I was shooting crystal meth and drinking Jack Daniels, and I took another human being's life. And I knew standing there, they busted me and took me in, and my family was there. I had no regard for any feelings for my family. My wife and daughter were there along with some other kids. We were living in that insane. We'd been there in that insane environment for over 2 weeks, and it was just absolutely crazy. 3 nights before that happened, my wife was, it was so hot in the desert in there. We had an old camper. Sue had a big old wig on her head. She used to wear them big wigs because she wanted to fix her hair, and she was sleeping up in the top of that damn camper, and about midnight while that wig turned around on her head, and I was sleeping down by the door, and in the middle of the night, she thought a wild animal had come in that camper and got on her face, and she throwed that wig out the back door. I shot 6 holes in that sucker before it hit the ground. I ruined a $150 wig. That's how crazy it was. Had no regard for life or, you know, safety or anything. It was just absolutely insane. 3 days later, a couple of days later, I end up in, getting in that fight with, people. It's one of those things, if you hang around with people like that, that's where it goes. And I ended up taking another human being's life and eventually had to stand trial for that. And through a series of events, it went down to self-defense because the guy had threatened me and publicly. And I had some people that, witnessed the deal. And it went down as a justifiable homicide self-defense. And I stood in that courtroom that day. Some friends brought me some Reds, and I'd been sucking on some Red Mountain wine around there, and I stood in that courtroom that day, and that judge talked to me about me, and he had the right guy. And what he talked to me about is the fact that I had taken another human being's life. I'd beat that man to the point that he was almost unrecognizable. And I showed absolutely no visible sign of guilt and remorse standing in that courtroom that day, and that's what baffled the people around me. It didn't baffle me because I was turned off. Alcohol and narcotics was still working in my life at that point in time. Standing in that courtroom, I had no visible sign of guilt and remorse. And yet, you know, the next night that I got back into my home, into my family, I shot straight up out of that bed, 1 o'clock in the morning, that lady laying next to me. And I looked at her, and she's got a black eye and a busted lip, and I'm sure it's just a matter of time. It's just a matter of time. didn't make any difference what I'd done and standing in that courtroom 2 days before that. I stood in there with all my partners, and I'm a cut above. And yet I know it's just a matter of time until I destroy everything around me, because you either attract all the things that you love the most, or you attract all the things you fear the most. 2 o'clock in the morning, shoot straight up out of that bed, run down a hallway down there where a little 9-year-old girl lived in the back of that house like a wounded animal, and put my head down next to her mouth and listen to see if she's breathing. Because it's just a matter of time till I kill them too. I'm going to have to kill them because they love me. And I hate me. And anything that says they love me has got to be destroyed. Because you either attract the things that you fear the most, or you attract the things that you love the most. And when I was fast-tracking that hate, that's all it's going to do. And the more I tried to destroy the hate, the more they tried to say that they love me, because the disease of alcoholism affects the families. I tried to destroy everything around me because I couldn't destroy myself. You can't even die if God don't want you to. Laying in my kitchen off in an old couch, coming off a 10-day run. My daughter, the only thing in her life that would show any kind of attraction to her, she was so bad because of the disease. Laying across the room, 6-8 feet across the room, she had an old Cocker Spaniel dog laying on her chest, hair all matted, looked just like her. Her head was all twisted, and lived in that house in absolute and total fear. And the jealousy and the rage inside of me, I come out of a blackout and I had a 9-shot 22 pistol laying on my chest, and that girl 6 feet away from me had that dog laying on her chest licking her in the face. And the jealousy, the absolute and total jealousy of the fact that that dog was showing love to my own daughter, and the absolute hate towards myself. I'm talking about hate towards me. I wanted to have that. I wanted to be able to show those emotions, and yet I can't because the way I'm living is destroying me and everything about me. And I shot that dog 9 times. The last time I shot that dog was right in the eye, 6 inches from my daughter's head, and she never moved an inch. And her mother standing in the kitchen 6 feet away never said a word. Nobody cried. Nobody showed any emotions. Nobody showed any emotions, because if you show any emotions, you might be next. You know, this is a hospital and institution conference. There's a lot of people in here who go to the hospitals and institutions. Maybe even people who are never been there. A lot of the people who are involved in H&I work have never been in an institution. I remember when I was pretty new, maybe 2 years sober, I got to go on a panel into San Quentin. I live in Southern California. I got to go on a panel in San Quentin. I felt very privileged to be able to go. I went with a young lady from Hollywood who had been married to a producer or somebody like that, drank her way into almost Skid Row, into the point that she finally came to AA. She had a little apartment. She's a beautiful young lady, had a short skirt on. I felt very privileged to be able to even be in the car with her, to tell you the truth. There was a doctor, there was a psychiatrist, and a lawyer, and he took me, the bad guy. And we went to San Quentin, and we were sitting in San Quentin, and each one of us got to share 15 minutes. There's 350 people, this was years ago, 350 people in that room, all men. And they were mostly looking at that little gal with that short skirt on. And each one of them got to share. An amazing thing is it came down to the last person that got to share. They had a little coffee break, you know, and people coming up and talking. I didn't know what to say. I remembered what old Wes Farrar from Bakersfield used to tell me. I used to ask Wes, God bless him, he's gone now, but I asked Wes, I said, what do you talk to people in jails? They know how to get there. And he said, that's right, Keith. You go in there and you talk to them about what to do to stay out. And so I'm having those thoughts whenever I'm sitting there in San Quentin and these people are looking at the back of my head, and I'm thinking, you know, I got nothing. You know, the lawyer, he drank. He went to law school and he drank and he came to AA and everything's fine. Got his law practice. The doctor did the deal. He went to, you know, med school and everything. Got his intern, got his practice, socialized, And he did his thing and drank and went to AA and he got his practice back, didn't lose his license, and this little gal's doing fine, you know, and everybody's doing fine. And I'm sitting there, I'm 2 years sober, man, and the only thing I really got to say is that I ain't been to jail in 2 years. And AA works. And I'm trying to think what to say. It came my turn and I got up in front of those people, 350 of them standing there, and I thought, God, give me something to talk to these people about that's got some identity. And so I told him that story about that dog. And like tonight here, there's a distinct difference. Because in San Quentin, when I told 350 hard cons sitting in there, I told them the story about that dog. I said, I shot that dog. The last shot I shot in that dog was in that dog's eye, 6 inches from my daughter's head. And 350 cons stood up and went, yeah, you showed them. Just like their favorite team had just scored. That ain't what happened here tonight. It's quiet when I told that story. It makes the hair stand up on the back of my neck right this moment. And when I told that story in San Quentin, it made the hair stand up on the back of my neck whenever they did what they did. Because you see, they have to live that way in there. In an AA meeting. And I come from there, and because of this type of work and because of you, I don't have to live that way anymore. I'm free. I'm free. And that was one of the very first awarenesses of where I come from and the difference in how I live today because of this type of work. Now, I'm not going to tell you I just walked into Alcoholics Anonymous and everything's wonderful. I drank myself right into a terrible place. I ended up in Taft, California, in an old barracks over in Taft. My last drunk, I went in there somewhere around the 9th of January, 1976. I stayed a hit out over there because two different groups of people had contract on me. I owed $250,000. I mean, I had me some waves of the past following my turkey, I'll guarantee you. And I was in deep trouble, and I rolled out of there one more time, came back down into Southern California through a series of events, 12-step call. Little gray-headed man named Jack Callahan, love little Jack, call him every Tuesday. Little Jack always tells me every Tuesday, tells me to tell you guys this. Little Jack says, be sure and tell them people that you're talking to tonight that you wouldn't have a damn thing to say if it wasn't for me. Gotta love little Jack. Little Jack come and captured me and took me and put me in one of them detoxes. Not no fancy country club deal, a shake and bake, you know? Take 3 steps, laugh, 3 steps and cry. Don't get no value, man. You just get to walk it off. Eat a lot of bananas. And have a banana. You need some potassium. I ate so many bananas. I want to thank you for that basket, but man, hold the bananas. They put me in a detox. They put me in a room with a 300-pound crane operator that needed to sober up long enough to get 30 more days, and then he could retire and drink himself to death. And they put me in there with another little guy that's a welder. And there was 38 other people besides me in this old detox. And I mean, they took all my clothes off, gave me one of them green robes, bare-ass naked, and set me down on one of them old plastic couches. You just kind of stick. I did, especially because I hadn't had a solid bowel movement in at least a year. And hadn't been bathing real good. Had a long beard, long hair. Just went in there, took my clothes off, and I just stuck me to that couch, you know. And all these people come up and say, are you an alcoholic? I said, I don't know. What is one, you know? I've been in and out of AA, more out than in, for 4 years. I didn't learn nothing. I didn't know nothing. I didn't work the steps. I didn't get a sponsor. I didn't do anything. I just thought if you wasn't really an alcoholic, why, you just go in there and kind of get the heat off and everything would be fine. And they had me stuck to this couch in this AA thing, man. And all these people, these H&I people, these little panels, all these funny guys. They had some guy named Rotten Ron. He'd bring a bunch of people in there. He had Rotten Ron, Tender Tom, and Ungrateful Bud. I said, what, who in the hell are these people? You know, what are these people? I said, they're alcoholics. And they come over there and talk to me about being an alcoholic. I said, I need to do an inventory. I said, what's an inventory? He said, you mean to write your life story? I said, okay, I'll write it. I wrote from age zero. If you're going to do an inventory and autobiography, start when you're zero, right out of the womb, and then right up to about age 12. And, I mean, I couldn't do no more. I mean, I just felt guilty right on along the deal, you know. And then they had a bunch of people come take me to AA meetings, and they'd take me to these outside AA meetings, and we'd go out there and sit, and we always sit in the sick row. And had where all the weirdos were. And they had an old van. They put me in the van. Had them old plastic milk crates. And you sit down on one of them milk crates. And they take off real fast. And you'd slide to the back of the van, you know. Then they go 3 blocks, hit a red light, slam the brake on. And you slide all the way to the front. I remember sliding up in front of them, between them old timers. And I said, you know, I beat a man to death once. And he just took off, man. I just went to the back of the van. That's all you get. You can't scare those people. They don't care. And they'd take me to meeting, take me to sick meeting where all these sick people are talking all this sick stuff. I had to go to men's stags because they talk my native tongue, profanity. And I didn't know anything else. They'd take me in. These guys would share all this sick stuff. And I had some heat on, so I was packing a gun. I was going to AA meetings. I went to meetings where it was okay to pack a gun. If you didn't have one, to give you one at the door. Some guy's talking sick stuff. I take my gun out of my boot, get a bullet out of it, take a Pentatel pen, write his name on the bullet, hold it up. Say, I'm going to kill you right after the meeting. You're sick. They don't pay no attention to you. Put the bullet back in the gun. After two or three people share it, I think, well, they stand up and pray. Then they come and hug you. And I think, well, I'll just come back next week and throw a grenade in here and kill them all, you know. I didn't know what to do. They told me I had to clean up, you know. I had an old Harley Davidson wouldn't start and had an old pickup that went down the road crooked. So my sponsor had me put the bike in the back of the truck and he had some guy give me an old stereo, one of them little cassettes, and they recorded the sound of a Harley on a tape. And he said I could put that in the tape player, turn it up real loud and drive my truck around town and I could, you know, then I could feel at home. I didn't know what the hell he was talking about. I was just nuts. I'd sit in the back of the room and radiate hate. I just radiated hate. I didn't have no other feelings. I wasn't glad to be in AA. I had problems, man. I come day, I got problems. I got papers say I'm crazy. I got people want to kill me. I owe all this damn money. I got this crazy woman that's going to Al-Anon. The kid's going to Alateen. The dog's going to Alley Dog. The cat's going to Alley Cat. I ain't got nobody to react no more. She won't fight with me. I can't fight with her. Can't do this. Can't do that. Just nuts. That's the crazy. I'd sit down in the chair and I'd start out on the front row and I'd be in the back of the room. Time the meeting was over. I didn't know what the hell was going on. You know, some guy said, I hope you don't get what you deserve. And I said, why? And he said, because I'm sitting next to you. They made me secretary of a meeting. They railroaded me into being the secretary of the meeting, you know, and that means you got to handle the money. So I stole all the money, but I was sober, so I left an IOU. I seen that because the guy that was his treasurer of the meeting before, they asked him for a treasurer's report, and he stood up and said, I stole all the money. And they said, okay, just keep coming back, you know. So I figured that's what you're supposed to do. And I didn't know what to do. I didn't come to AA and quit stealing. They told me I would develop enough guilt, I'd have to double the money that I thought I stole. I remember hearing that. And they said things like, we won't guarantee you've had your last drink after tonight, but we'll guarantee you'll never enjoy another one. They screwed up my drinking, and they'd take me to meetings all the time and set me around. I could be the very best bad example. They made me secretary of this meeting, and they'd give me this funny suit, you know, got me some clothes on and a tie and some weird stuff, and they'd stand me up there, and I had to hug these people whenever they had a birthday cake, and I'd have to get people to come up and do stuff. I didn't know what was going on, so I'd just do just stand there and do the thing. After I was secretary for the meeting, while I was standing in there one night, there's a guy named Bob the Cop giving me an old dummy grenade. He was on a bomb squad, and so he got this old dummy grenade, and he said, here, hold on to this. Probably the closest thing to a spiritual experience you're ever going to have is if you put this in your mouth and pull the pin. And I didn't know what he was talking, just, okay, so I stood around holding my grenade all the time. I mean, nobody was standing next to me. I was just radiating hate. I didn't know what the hell to do, you know. My sponsor wouldn't stand next to me. He'd stand on the other side of the room. And when a newcomer would come in, he'd get him and talk to him. I asked this new guy, I said, what did my sponsor say about me? And he said, you know, your sponsor told me if I go back out and drink, I'll end up like you. I hated my sponsor. I didn't know what to do. I was standing there one day, you know, and I tried to work the steps. I did an immoral inventory, did a fear list, you know, I was afraid of everything. I didn't know how to do anything. How do you change all that stuff? I'd done all the steps the best I could, and I looked around, and there's a weirdo standing next to me, and I said, what do you want? And he said, I want you to be my sponsor. I didn't know what to do other than say, here, hold my grenade, you know, I mean. I got him in the car and started taking him to meetings, and he talked sick stuff to me, and sick stuff, and I didn't know what to say, you know, so I'd tell him some of my sick stuff, and he'd say, you're the sickest sucker I ever heard. We need to go to a meeting. You know, it's just like, who can be the worst sick, you know? And one time he said, I know you lied to me yesterday because it's physically impossible to do what you said you did last night. So you got to stand on your head in the hammock. Well, I knew he was a city boy, and I grew up on a farm, so I could always out-top him in the sex department. He ended up doing the steps with me, came over to my house, and he sat down and wanted to do the steps. I didn't know how to do it. I just did the best I could. We got on our knees and prayed, read that third step together. He crawled underneath my arm, and I put my arm around him and had that tingling sensation and questioned my sexuality again. I don't know. Everybody's hugging around here, for God's sakes. I don't know. And then, we tried to work the steps. He didn't know what, he couldn't write, so I wrote, and he talked, and then he said, "Did you ever do anything like that?" And I said, "Yeah, I did some stuff like that." So I put some of my stuff in his, I mean, he can't read. What the heck? He can pack a little of my stuff out. God don't care, just as long as you get it out, And then he jumped up and kissed me and said, "I love you." And I said, divorce her and follow him. I don't know. Everybody wacko around. I didn't understand those kind of emotions. Where I'd been around, and nobody was running around kissing each other unless you were ready to fall in love, which meant you were next. And I didn't know. But I did the deal, and I started doing those kinds of things, and I started following that kind of directions. And I've always had sponsorship. My kind of alcoholic needs sponsorship. I've always had sponsorship, and I'm grateful that I've had those kind of teachers ahead of me. And there's been some great teachers in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've had some great teachers and people who've taught me and got me involved in service. I recognized that there was some big gaps in sobriety. I would see people get, a year, and then they're gone by the time they get five. I see some people get 5 years of sobriety, and they're gone. They never see them until they get 10. And I saw those things, and my wife was going to Al-Anon, my kids were going to Al-Anon, and they started getting involved in service. They've been involved in service, doing all kinds of things. Sue, coming out of that insanity, was going into all kinds of different battered women's homes and doing all kinds of service in her world service and intergroup and things like that. And I saw that there's bound to be something there that where you can be involved that keeps you busy. And I had all this insane energy, and I needed to get busy, and I started getting involved in service at a very early time, and going on panels and going into jails. We went into the small jails and in the hospitals, and I'm not a person that's going to put down any hospitals. I believe I come out of one of those kind of detoxes, and I personally, I wouldn't have been able to sober up. Physically, I couldn't have made it any other way, and I'm grateful for those people, because that period I had to stay in that hospital for over a month. And I'm grateful of that, because the first 2 weeks in there, I didn't even know, I couldn't retain anything. And after the second week, and by the third week, I started grasping what's going on. And they explained to me, I got a disease, and it's affected my family. And they brought my family. I remember the psychiatrist brought my family and brought my wife and my daughter in there. And my daughter said, my wife's in there, and they asked my daughter, why do you feel about your father? And my daughter said, I hate his guts. Now I'd heard that. I'd heard that all the time, drinking. But sitting there on that couch in that hospital, and that psychiatrist asked her that, my wife jumped straight up and said, I'm good. I'm glad you're hearing that sober, you SOB. And I had the guilt. I knew she felt like that. And then my wife sat down, and then the psychiatrist said to my wife and my daughter, she asked my daughter, how do you feel about your mother? And my daughter said, I hate her guts. And sitting there that day sober, I knew that my wife and the disease of alcoholism in her life had done just as much damage to that little girl as me as a drunk. Because daddy's drunk, but what's wrong with mom? And I started putting some of those things together. Those pieces started coming together because the professional people, who had studied the disease of alcoholism was explaining it to a family who just had pieces of the puzzle up to including that point in time. And as I shared with you, there were some absolutely unbelievable things. If you want to see my fifth step, go see that movie, Dolores Claiborne. That's my fifth step. That's a kind of rage. Only two things in that movie I didn't do. I didn't die and I didn't molest my daughter, but it was at that point. That was coming. Because at that point I was drinking and using so much that I couldn't control any of those sex drives, and they would come uncontrollably. And when they came, I almost cherished that moment, and it went off in any direction. And I knew that. I knew I couldn't control those things. It's just a matter of time. And those people in that hospital explained those things to our family, and they put them together. They put that family together. They said, you need recovery. They told me in front of my wife and my daughter, these professional people said, it's absolutely impossible for me, the alcoholic, to go home and live in a sick environment and stay clean and sober. An alcoholic can't go home to an old idea and stay sober. He will either have to leave or he will drink again. And today I can say I've seen that happen over and over and over. And I'm so grateful that the professional people took the time to explain that to my family. And they told my wife, she's going to have to get help. She's going to have to go to Al-Anon. And they told my daughter, she's going to have to go to Alateen. And I was glad to hear that. I was extremely glad to hear that. They told me I had to take Antabuse. I didn't know about it. I'd done some of that tricky stuff. But they said the psychiatrist explained to me that I needed to take the Antabuse in front of my daughter so my daughter could build trust in what I was trying to do to stay sober. Not as a crutch to support my sobriety, but as an act to build trust with people who feared me and could not trust me. And so I believed that professional person, and I started taking Antabuse. And my daughter, it's unbelievable, my daughter would come and watch me take that pill in the morning because that's the only thing she savored that moment, because that's the only thing that she could equate that was going to help me stay sober. And I didn't understand. I was just given the direction by the professional people to do that. And I remember after something like 90 days or something like that, I didn't take it anymore and she wasn't watching me anymore. I was standing on my own sobriety. But that act had built trust with that kid. Just by the simple fact I was trying to do those things. My daughter hated it because we made her go to Alateen. And I'm grateful that we did that. I think one of the most hypocritical things that it is for an alcoholic or a dope fiend to come to a program, 12-step program, that teaches them how to live and develop a relationship with a God and deny their family of the same recovery and the same spiritual values. How could you be so hypocrite to come here and get it and say, but I'm not going to give it to my family. I've hurt them enough. Bullshit. They need it more than anybody. You bet. And I am eternally grateful that the people in the professional community saw a sick family and insisted that we all get help. They insisted. My daughter hated me. She'd go to Alateen, she'd say, all they do is talk about sex, drugs, and rock and roll. I said, well, just like home. And I remember after she'd gone to Alateen, her mother had to take her to Alateen. I was so busy trying to stay sober and crazy, I couldn't do it. And that's why the family has to be able to grow together and get the help from the institutions and the people. And Sue would take her to the Alateen. Instead of chasing the drunk, I'm going to AA, she would take her to Alateen. And she was dependable, and she'd take that kid to Alateen, and she'd go to an Al-Anon meeting right out of that damn joint, man. I mean, right out of that deal. She took him and went there herself. And it took a year and a half before my daughter could have a feeling. And I'll never forget the night she came home from that Alateen meeting. She's lit up like a Roman candle because she had sat there for a year and a half until the night came whenever a little girl like her walked in her meeting, and she went and helped her. And the little girl asked her to be her sponsor. Now, I share this with you for one reason only. Right now, within a few weeks, Sue and I have been in this program almost 19 years, but it's taken years. And in the institutions, I'm talking about the penitentiaries and even some of the hospitals, it is so hard to get the family recovery to come. And then within a few weeks, Sue's going to meet with some people as an Al-Anon representative. After all these years it's taken for her to be able to get enough credibility in CIW to be able to get acknowledged. And the reason she was acknowledged, because she was at the Southern California H&I convention, and I don't know whether it was Jim or somebody, one of those guys was talking about this, and all these Al-Anons stand up because they're taking panels into penitentiaries. And one of the most important things for the institutions is to be able, when that convict gets out of there, have some kind of a foundation for their goddamn family. Because they go back into that old place, into that old playground with them old playmates and them sick women and them sick kids, and it's impossible for them to have the recovery. If we don't get some kind of recovery in those families, the convicts are not going to have anything to come out to. They'll have nothing but old ideas. And it's one of the most important breakthroughs as far as the family recovery in the institutions that's been done in years. In very few places anywhere in the United States do you have Al-Anon. I remember I went in with Sue and the CIW, and it's an Al-Anon, and Sue's in there talking to them, telling them a little bit of our story of our family. And a Dauphine gal sitting in the back stood up and said, "What the hell can you do for me? I'm an alcoholic, I'm a Dauphine, you're an Al-Anon. What can you do for me in here?" And I watched my wife. We've been together 35 years. We've been through hell. And she knows. She's not stupid. And I know she knew. And I knew she had a God in her life. And I watched her. And she waited a minute and let that room focus on that statement. And Sue looked at that gal and she said this: "Did you have family when you were out there drinking and using? Did you have family that sat in that courtroom when you got your sins? Do you have family outside these walls?" And the gal said, "Yeah." Sue said, "That's us. That's us." And it is absolutely unbelievable the magic that I've seen happen with those women in that institution. The healing because of the Al-Anon program. I watched this. I watched them be able to take those steps and turn them around and make some amends with those families. To understand what the family felt when they were doing those things is so important for the forgiveness. To understand how the people felt, to understand how the victims... You know, one of the amazing things, you know, I go into these institutions all the time, and the people who are trying to get out of them, they have to go before a parole board or some kind of a group that talks to them. And one of the most important things that they talk to me about when I go into some of these panels is, how can you learn how to forgive yourself so that when you're sitting in front of a parole board, you don't show some kind of a sign that you're going to get even with the victims or the people that had something to do with you? Will these steps help me forgive those people that I feel like have wrongly, unjustly put me in here, right or wrong? And I'll never forget being able to stand there and say, if you'll put these steps in your life, you can forgive yourself. If you can forgive yourself, you can forgive anyone. It is in forgiving that we are forgiven. And the absolute forgiveness. I've gone to the institutions and been able to see people who have been in there for over 20 years and their own cellmates didn't know them. Stand up in a meeting and tell a little bit of their story, which is a breakthrough on a fifth step. I learned how to be able to be gentle and be considerate to women by going into institutions, because I came to this program a woman hater, and I did enough inventory work to be able to recognize that I didn't hate women, I hated God. My resentment was at God. And I go in those women's institutions with my wife and my family, and we showed them how a family comes back together, how we put a family back together, and how we were able to forgive each other for what we'd done. And to be able to sit in those institutions, particularly the women's institutions, and look high, man. You can't look down. Can't sneak a peek. They tested me. Oh, they come in there, man. They come in there. They got the cleavage showing and everything. And they watched me. They watched me to see if I was coming in there to sneak a peek or if I was coming in there to carry the message. AA. You bet. They tested me. And I've built a trust in there over the past 5 years in CIW that's beyond anything I ever imagined. Some of those ladies in there have never even had anything like a father. And I'm the closest thing to a father that some of them had that have been in there for 10 or 15 years and aren't that old. To be able to go in there and carry the message of recovery. You know, I remember when I was brand new sitting in that detox, that old detox, and they put 38 of us in a circle, me counting 39. And they went around the room. They let us take each other's inventory. They started on my left, and they went around. And each one of those people, they said, you know, it's a great thing, and there's beautiful things that have happened here, and I think we all got a chance. But that guy Keith, man, he's too crazy. He ain't going to make it. He's winged. You know, he's a wing nut. He ain't going to make it. And they told me that because we'd been in there for over a month together in that institution, and they knew. They could see, you know, there was a lot of insanity. They hoped I could, and their prayers were with me, but it just didn't look. I was like a wild animal inside of myself. And I remember when it got to me, I mean, the vote was 38, that I was gonna hit the street and get loaded. And I did my first AA resentment. I said, I'll see y'all in hell before I get loaded. And I want to tell you, this is something I love to take in the institution. This ain't a popularity contest, and to hell with the vote, because I'm the only one out of 39 that's still clean and sober. You bet. I want to share a story with you real quick. And particularly those of us who get to go into these institutions, these hospitals and institutions, it's very important, the example that we portray, the example that we set. There was a family, a beautiful family, they lived in England. And all their life, they wanted to come to America and they had no money. And they saved their money, they worked hard. There was a father and a mother and a little girl, and they worked hard and they saved their money, and all they could think about was be able to come to America. Someday he's going to come to America, home of the brave, land of the free. It was a dream. And after over a year, they had enough money to buy a ticket on a great ocean liner. And they bought the tickets, all three of them. They've got their tickets, and they packed their stuff, and they had some cheese and crackers, and they packed their lunch, and they went down. They had just, the father just had a little bit of change. That's all he had. And they could only just dream about what it's going to be like when they got to America. And their dream was coming true. And they crawled on this big ocean liner, and away they went, man. And two or three days out, the little girl was eating crackers and cheese. And she just got so tired of eating crackers and cheese that she couldn't stand it anymore. And she went to her father, and she said, Daddy, Daddy, you got to do something. I just can't handle eating crackers and cheese the rest of the journey. I'm going to go crazy. I'm going to jump off or something. You got to do something. And the father, being a good father, he loved his daughter, he loved his family, the dreams come true. He reached in his pocket and he pulled out a nickel, and he gave the little girl a nickel, and he said, go up to the galley and get yourself an ice cream cone. And the little girl took off, and she was gone 2 hours, and the father was worried. He just, you know, he was out of himself, and he couldn't wait, and pretty soon she showed up, and she's grinning from ear to ear. And the father said, where you been? So I was worried sick about you. So I've been up in the galley, said, I got two ice cream cones and a steak. And the father said, you got two ice cream cones and a steak for a nickel? And the little girl said, no, Daddy. The food comes with a ticket. It's been free all along. That's a story about teachers. The food comes with a ticket. Man, I ain't gonna settle for crackers and cheese. I am not going to do it, and ignorance is no excuse. I want steak and ice cream, baby. I want the whole deal. I want the whole enchilada. I'm willing to do what you got to do to sit up there and do it, and it comes with a ticket. Don't limit yourself. I came here looking like I was... Everything in my life was like I was looking through a straw. I couldn't see. I had no peripheral vision. I had nothing. I was living with a family that was insane, the violence and all kinds of sickness of this disease. And because of Alcoholics Anonymous, and because of people like you and service work like this, I've been able to walk out in the sunlight of the Spirit. I've been able to see the good and enjoy the good and be able to enjoy the freedom and to be able to have that openness where there is no secrets. God, if there's one thing that has given me the greatest transparency is to be able to walk in a place where the walls confine us all and understand there is no secrets in there. And I understood by going in these institutions that I'm as sober as I am secret, that we're all the same. Because I know everything there is to know about you the minute I sit down in those rooms. Because I've either done it or thought of doing it and felt just as guilty for thinking as I did for doing it. And sitting in those places, I come to understand something about me. Something about me. I got no secrets. If there is no secrets, there is no gossip. If I got no place in my life where the sunlight of the Spirit can shine, then there are no dark corners, there's nothing to hide. That I'm just me. And that's all I ever wanted to be. You gave me that. In a particularly service work like this. You know, I remember David's going to talk tomorrow night. I love it. I have more fun doing things like this. You're going to love David. I love David. He's been one of my, I guess he's a hero. We were back in St. Louis. Sue and I was back in St. Louis at a hospital deal, and we was going to do a little talking back there in one of these deals, and they was going to have a barbecue. And you got to have fun with these things, you know. They had all these families, and they didn't know nothing around there, and they had this big grassy knoll hillside, you know, they had all these tents set up, and we're back there at this big hospital, and we're doing it, and David's, we're walking around there Saturday afternoon, and they got all these chicken breasts cooking on these barbecues. I don't know, must have been 1,000 chicken breasts up there on them barbecues. You know, we're walking around there, and I'm talking to David, you know. David's talking to me, and I'm telling him, said, you know, some guy wants to do a video of me so he can take it in the institution. David looked at me, and he said, you know, you could probably handle everything but the makeup. I love it when they just have that little piece of wisdom, you know. They just know you. And we're walking around out there, and this dude's cooking all these chicken breasts, you know, and all these hospital patients are wandering around on their Thorazine, you know, and Goofy, you know. And I think, what the hell am I doing here? David's taking my inventory. I'm with Sue, and, you know, I ought to be back in Texas or some damn place. I don't know. And all of a sudden, the grease on this big grill run down to one corner, and then there was a big propane tank on the back of this truck, and it had a hose that went up to this grill, and that grease out there run down that rubber hose and caught fire. And that propane tank blew up. And it blew 1,000 chicken breasts about a mile in the air. And it rained chicken breasts. And all the patients are walking around looking like, what the hell is this? And David said, my dream has come true. I said, what? Tell me. Scared the hell out of me. He said, I prayed to see a million hot breasts, and it looks like it's coming true. And you got to be able to laugh at it. You got to be able to have fun with it. You never know whenever somebody's going to get some help. You never know whenever you're going to get a memory that you can draw from. You never know when you're ever going to be able to do something that you can go back home that night and put your head on that pillow and say, man, it was worth it. I was standing in a place like this a few years ago, and a young guy had been walking around there, and he come up behind me and stood behind me. I'm watching him, and pretty soon I, how you doing, son? And he walked up there to me and said, you don't remember me, but you come into a hospital and talked, and I was brand new. I didn't know anything about what was going on, but you made me laugh. You made me laugh. And I thought, you know, I remember that an old timer told me that laughter is so important because it's what opens the door of the sick mind. The door of the sick mind opens from the inside out. We can't open it from the outside. And it's only the laughter that allows it to open. And if we can laugh just for a second, the door will open and bam, you can stick the message in. And this young guy is standing there next to me, and he said, I just want to tell you something. I don't remember him. You know, I said, sure, kid, I remember you. I talk about you all the time. You know, I got him to laugh, you know. But he said, I just got to tell you something. He said, my sponsor. He said, I'm sober now. I'm sober 5-6 years. He said, my sponsor, the most important person in my whole life, the person that taught me how to live, the person that loved me more than my own father, my sponsor is dying of cancer. And he's sober a long time. And I want my sponsor, I want him to go out like a winner. And he said, my sponsor is thinking about committing suicide. My sponsor with over 26 years of sobriety is thinking about drinking because this cancer and this pain is eating him up. And he said, I wanted my sponsor to go out a winner. And I didn't know what to do. He said, the only thing I could think of was that I remembered you coming over there and you helped me when I was new. So I went and got your tape, and I took the copy of that tape over to my sponsor, and I gave your tape to that dying man that meant so much to me. And I don't know what you said. I don't even know where the tape come from, but I gave that tape to him, and he listened to it, and he got to go out a winner because of something you said gave him hope and gave him the strength to hold on right up to the very end. And I want to thank you for giving my sponsor what he deserved. And he turned around and he walked away. You bet. That's the AA. That's what we're about. That's what this whole weekend's about. And that's what this whole feeling is about. And we start it tonight, and it's going to be a fantastic weekend. It's going to be a fantastic weekend that we can come and fill our cup. That we can be with people like Jim and some of the other professionals that come here this weekend. We can entertain them as our guests, members of this program, and we can show them the enthusiasm we have about what they allow us to do in their institutions. It's so important. And I know we're going to have a great thing. This is a kickoff deal, and you're going to enjoy David and some of the other people. Sue's here. Sue and I have been out. We've been together for 35 years. I love her. She's my wife, my very best friend. She's my lover, and she ain't my sponsor, and I'm grateful as hell for that. We got some other speakers here, and it's going to be a great weekend, and let's all enjoy it. God bless, and thank you.